it's fascinating, some of the people that were, you know, not members of the church, but certainly impacted by the Mennonite community.
Mm-hmm. And part of the community overall.
Yeah, right. And part of the community, right. I mean, Betty Vandenberg is another mm-hmm. one of those persons. I'm thrilled to see her at Mount Pleasant, but she was, most of her adult life, she was a member at Centerville.
There's an attorney, Donna Swain, I didn't make the connection until about a month ago. She's a former attorney. Now she's retired and does real estate with she and her husband. And she and I and her husband are the only board members on a condominium in western part of Chesapeake. And she's quite a talker. And I made the connection somehow and asked her, and I got 2 hours of Swain history.
Did you say Donna Swain? Now, there's another Donna Swain who is a niece of Betty.
Yeah, that's her.
That's her? I guess we're talking about the same person.
Steve Swain's daughter?
Yeah. Well, she was my biology student many, many years ago. I mean, we don't see each other too often, but, appreciation for each other. And she's married to Dudley, who has a mechanical shop.
He's retired now.
Right.
And
right.
Mainly fixes up houses and does a little repair work with her.
Yeah. My next door neighbor, Scott Chester.
Oh, right in the corner there.
Right. I worked for him for years. Connections. But anyway, go ahead. Well, you were just saying that that Donna talked to you off?
Oh, she always does. When the phone rings, I know this is going to be a half hour. In fact, I always answer the phone to her. Okay, Donna, who are we going to shoot today?
Bless her heart. Yeah, I think a lot of her. When Bobby Vandenberg was very ill and not far from death, I had visited a couple of times, and I would bump into to these nieces. Mm-hmm. See, she has a sister who lives down on Long Ridge. Her name's not coming to me right. Connie. But we better talk about whatever it is you'd like to talk about.
About you and your perspectives and experiences. Were you folks living in the house you grew up in when you were born, or are they living somewhere else?
No, I was, Shirley Buckwalter was my first neighbor. I was born, and until I was 4 years old, lived back on Wanger Road on the old Grandpa Clayton house.
Okay.
You remember that house?
I do.
I'm sure.
We had Sunday dinner there once when I was a little kid.
Yeah, I guess I was probably, I don't know, I was something like four to five, when we moved mm-hmm. to the newly built house over here.
How old were you when you had to start taking part in the farm chores and milking cows?
Oh, man, that's a... at 6 years old, I would help with the milking. I think my job was to wash the udders.
Yeah.
And, you know, prep the cows for having the milking machine put on. At 8 years old, I was put on the Ford tractor with the bush hog mower to mow pasture. My children or grandchildren do that, but that, thank God I'm still here.
Did you have any close calls, or?
Well, not in regards to that. No. In my youth, I had a number of farm-related accidents that, were mostly my fault, my carelessness or inexperience. Mm-hmm. But so would you remember when a bush hog mower fell on me?
What happened?
So it happened right out here in what, you know, was Grandpa's yard. This is a heavy bush hog mower.
The kind of mess on the back of a tractor, or?
Yeah, it wasn't three-point hitch.
Okay.
It had, it was a pull behind, and had the ratchet type jack.
Okay.
As you raise the thing, the threaded bars of the ratchet jack would continue to extend, and none of us realized that then. But, you know, there's a point where they end, and in which case the mower falls. And so Amos Lehman was standing on top of the mower, jacking it up, and I foolishly went underneath. The intention was to sharpen the blades, take the blades off and sharpen them. We were both foolish in that there's actually a little port. You're supposed to be able to avoid that by pulling the port open and undoing the bolt that, or bolts that held the blades in place. When that is done, all one would have to do is just reach under the mower and pull the blade out and do the sharpening and then fasten it back in. So I had no business being under there. It caught me right here.
Close the back?
Yeah. And I fortunately didn't do anything to my spinal cord, but I did crack two vertebrae just slightly. You know, kidney damage, temporary kidney damage, thank God. And was in the hospital 11 days.
Great day.
Of course, that was back in...
How old were you?
I was 15.
Invulnerable.
Yeah. As I saw it then, the worst result was that I couldn't play softball the rest of that year. As I look on it now, it was just that far away from death. I mean, if it had been another part of my body, it could easily have resulted in my death. But anyway, that was the worst one. There were some others too. My brother Leonard, when he was real little, was driving the tractor and wagon to pick up wheat straw. And I, again foolishly, tried to get on the wagon while it was moving slowly. Mm-hmm. And I fell in front of the wagon, and Leonard wasn't able to reach the clutch, really. And so the wagon ran over me. How many more stories do you have? And there are a couple of others that were more minor than those two. I'd say they were.
Who was your first teachers at Mount Pleasant when you started school there? Was that Lamar Wenger?
Yeah.
And there were still, was it three rooms or two rooms when you started?
When I started, there were only two rooms.
Okay.
Now, I'm trying to think, you know, there was definitely, by the time I got to the seventh grade, and I believe what Dale and Preston and some of those guys would have been in the 10th grade, but we were clearly in the upper school room at that point, the third room, which I'd help whitewash the walls or something like that, with my dad or with my grandpa. Both Aline and Leona Krupp had both successively come to Mount Pleasant. So they were, each of them, I think, were my teachers for a year, maybe. My first teacher was Mrs. Wenger.
Anything particularly you remember about her?
I do. I think I wrote a little tribute to be read at her funeral because it turned out I had to be out of town for something. To summarize that little piece I wrote, it's just that I way underestimated the contribution she made to my life, and you know, I'll always wish that I was had expressed my gratitude more. Granted, she had her quirks and all of that. Did you ever hear that she didn't think other books should be placed on top of the Bible?
Yes.
Okay.
I heard Brother Hunter say that too.
Okay. Well, maybe I shouldn't even call that a quirk, but I don't recall ever hearing that from anyone else.
I still feel guilty if I do it.
Okay. But in terms of English and literature, she got me in a position where I thrived with those classes then at Great Bridge. Mrs. Gendel and Mr. Halterman. Do you remember him, by any chance?
Yeah, both of them.
Okay. Yeah. So all right. Lanier Halterman bless his heart, he's only died about, what, a year ago or something?
It's been recently, yeah.
But do you know, he sent me a card and condolences when Rose died.
Really?
And came to see me when my mom died. He, at that point, he wasn't able to drive, but his wife drove him, and just we had a nice... So anyway, I always felt very blessed that somehow he followed me. But my ability to, you know, confidently interact with literature and with Ms. Gendel in writing was really due to Lenore Wanger's teaching.
Was she still having the one hymn a week, or maybe it was one hymn a month? I think it was one hymn a week. When you went there, when I was there, she would introduce a new hymn every week, tell us the story behind the hymn, and we sang that one song every morning for a week.
Really? I don't remember that.
I thought I was the only one who remembered it, and I ran into Sidney Wanger, that was about a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And some song came on, and he said, that's a Mrs. Wanger song.
Huh.
I said, I remember those hymns.
Huh. Interesting. I think your sister Needy, I think, kind of picked that up. Hasn't she been known for giving the history behind the song?
Yeah. Have a brother Wanger, any particular memories of him?
Yeah. Same thing, I would say. I was kind of a jerk, and he was really straightforward with me about... I know he chided me once, maybe more than once, but at least once, for kind of using the verbal politeness, yes sir, yes sir. But he said he'd much rather see action than for me to keep using those nice words.
Mm-hmm.
And once he was some misbehavior that I was into, and he was reprimanding me, and I said, well, I'm trying. Well, trying's not enough. So I guess that's how bad I was, Alan.
When you talk about the literature, I just finished, there was a book called A.D. and Annie that the family put together, and I just finished reading it, and apparently he and Lenora had little games they played between themselves all their lives.
Really?
Regarding literature, knowledge of, and language.
Really?
And punctuation, and the proper use of words, and so forth, and it was like a game they played to try to outdo each other.
That is fascinating. Well, that would figure into what I've just told you about. Mm-hmm. I know I wasn't the only one. You were probably in the same boat, but I had the sense, when I got to Great Bridge High School, you know, I wasn't coming out of some second-rate preparatory education.
No, and in fact, the people who came from that school at my time had an easy time of it at Great Bridge.
Right. I would probably say the same. I mean, Joan Miller Steininger was valedictorian of my class.
Where did you go to college after you graduated?
EMC.
Okay, is that where you met Rose?
That is where I met Rose, right.
How'd you all meet?
Well, first, she came a year after me. By the time my sophomore year, when I first met Rose, I had become involved somewhat with it. What was that? YPCA? Young People's? Well, anyway, the spiritual club's not the word. Organization that encouraged connection with ministry, whether that was community, young people's, it would almost be like a community ministry to the youth of the area, that kind of thing, or in some cases help with some of the smaller churches and so on. Anyway, so I was involved with that, and I remember in fall of 1970, as the freshman class, which Rose was part, closed in, I somewhat involved with inviting new freshmen to join the, I think it's YPCA. So I hit on Rose. But the other thing was my farm habits. I was accustomed to eating breakfast. Probably 90% of my peers in college did not eat breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And Rose had a work-study job. She was a breakfast cook. She was a good cook in our married life, but I know she probably wasn't the greatest cook in the cafeteria. But so we see each other at breakfast, too. There you go. And there's lots more I could tell. But
And it just evolved from that.
Yeah. And then there was a breakup. I came home for a year. I decided when I did go back, over a couple of reasons, but one of the primary ones was I decided I liked her better than I thought earlier.
Did you all get married while you were still in school or after you graduated?
Just after Rose graduated. Let's say she graduated in whatever it was, May of 1974, and we were married in August of 74.
Did you move back here then?
So we continued to live a year in Harrisonburg, where I still had a part-time job, still had a class or two to finish. Then we moved down here in 1976.
Where did you live?
Francis and Edna's initially. I was a trailer there, and then, you know, later Velma, was that Rodney's trailer maybe? Or
I don't know how that came about, because they had a little daughter house.
Yeah, for my grandma.
For your grandmother.
Right.
And I know some of the teachers had lived there when they taught at Mount Pleasant.
Okay.
From time to time. Ruth Kurtz.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The
trailer was after my time.
Okay.
And I don't know if I ever knew why or how the trailer got there.
We felt warmly welcomed. Uncle Francis showed his softer side to.
He had one, huh?
Right. But that was interesting experience. We were only there for 1 year. We had, there was some kind of a skirt under the trailer, but it was far from vomit-proof. So there were a host of black snakes under the, and the mice were, I've never lived in a place where there were so many mice. I mean, this is the truth. I threw a table knife into a counter where I saw a mouse, and I actually managed to hit and kill the mouse. That was probably because he was so fat and full that he couldn't move it. That's where we lived until we built this house up here, 2117.
Were you teaching school then?
Oh, yeah. Fall of 75, I did student teaching then. That was an arrangement where I had a professor to come down from EMC maybe two times during the semester or something like that, just to check in. Well, anyway, it was a distance arrangement, but it worked out very well. And then I then worked on the farm here for 76, 77, 78, and then was hired as a biology teacher at Great Bridge for the fall of 79.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught from 79 through 82.
Did you ever teach up here at Mount Pleasant?
I never did. No, I was on the board for I can't remember which years, and of course, you know, my sister Kathy was deeply involved in the school, but no, I never taught there.
One of the things I've run into, and it seems to be almost universal, with a few exceptions, are that the women who moved into the community because they married some young fellow who lived here have expressed never feeling at home here, as if they were never insiders. They were always outsiders. Some quite vociferously, some a little less so, but always that this was never home. Did Rose have that? Because she seemed such a dynamic personality and so adopted. I wondered if she.
Yeah, good question. I honestly don't think so. There was maybe initially just a little bit of awkwardness, but it really didn't have to do with being accepted by the congregation and community as a whole. Rose didn't grow up wearing the covering, even though she was a member of the Salford Mennonite Church. Brother Wanger asked that she wear one, at least the first year or two that she taught. And a couple of other, I guess, little things like that. Rose seemed to be able to take them in stride and wasn't too big an issue for her. I would say, to be honest, for a couple of reasons, Rose probably felt less accepted by the Berge family. Not my parents, but we were kind of a rough bunch in some ways, and not as gracious maybe as we might have been. I don't know. I want to include myself in that or not. Maybe I should. But you're right in assessing Rose, and I don't think she ever felt rejected by the community as a whole or a misfit. She was Well, you know that she never quite fit the mold, any mold, whether it's, you know, the way a preacher's wife should be.
She was unique.
Yeah, she was very unique, right. And even her friends from back in the Franconia area would say the same thing. She was actually a sought-after friend in her growing up mm-hmm. years, not just with guys, but with other girls mm-hmm. too. And, you know, just because she was, you know, this vivacious and sometimes ridiculous.
Franconia Conference, what community did she grow up in?
The Salford Mennonite Church.
What town is that near?
Harleysville.
I don't know Harleysville.
Let's see. What would be the closest? Well, it's not that far from Lansdale. Make a connection? Mm-hmm. For whatever it's worth, it's the, you know, they love their townships up there, right, mm-hmm. within the county. Montgomery County doesn't mean too much, but the township.
Yeah.
So it's in Lower Salford Township, has a little park by a creek, and it's the Bergie Park. So, you know, in some ways I came home, but that little Bergie Park and the original Bergie who came to the U.S. in 1717 has a grave marker in the Salford Mennonite Church graveyard.
Now, Clayton Bergie had moved away from Salford, hadn't he?
In fact, he was born at the Blooming Glen Mennonite Church, which was right on the Montgomery County, Bucks County line, so east of...
Was that Lancaster County, Lancaster Conference?
No, it's all Franconia Conference. By the way, they've just changed names there. Now, you know, Mennonite mm-hmm. Mosaic.
I'm an old-timer. I still think of them as Franconia.
Yeah, sure. Fortunately, I think they might have been known as the most enmeshed Mennonite community. Yeah, that would be...
Is he an immigration now? He's got a lot of immigration.
A little bit.
Okay.
No time for secrets yet.
Not too many. One time Paul Everall told me to come up on that old Bergie money. I still haven't seen that money.
Well, Paul would be concerned about that.
He wanted to sell me his house.
Yeah, Needy has this little joke that she has, which Paul and Olin both loved. He said, "Do you know how copper wire was invented? Olin had a pen and was required to share it with Paul."
I like that.
Yeah, I've seen Franconia Conference move from that sort of enmeshed, very everybody knows everybody's business, and there's kind of, well, there's no question, but what I was probably partly well received because I was Rose's husband, and partly well received because, hey, there's Bergies all around us here. You must be one of those somehow, you know.
How did you make the transition into preaching? What was the process there? How did you get in? How did that happen?
I don't even know. Well, I'll just tell you how it started anyway. This would have been 1988.
You're still teaching then, or you were?
I was not. I was then working on the farm. And by the way, I think I've told you this before. I thought that my trying several different jobs and maybe a good thing, and maybe it was, but if I had it to do over again, I would not do so much bouncing, teaching, preaching, managing a business, etc.
Why?
I just think that I could have done better. I wish in pastoring I had spent more time and attention in training and continuing to develop as a spiritual leader. I guess having spent more years at that. But the same thing here with my bouncing into and out of Bergie's Dairy Farm actually was a detriment. It came in 1982, I guess, full of vision and fascination with the possibilities that... So, you know, in that time, of course, it wasn't just me. There were other of my siblings who were involved as well, but we went from period of time, we went from no dairy store to 3 dairy stores. We went from door-to-door retail delivery to retail and wholesale delivery. We started making ice cream, which we had never done before. You know, increase the herd size probably over a period of 5 to 10 years, it doubled the herd size and all of that. And that was rapid growth and rapid collapse. You know, all of those things, the majority of those things, only lasted for about 2 decades. And then, you know, gone a week. As you know, started over again. So, anyway, but let me get back to the ministry part. So I'm on the tractor back there on the Schloss farm, and Robert Mass comes walking across the field. Have you heard me tell this before?
No.
Both Brother Phil had just had a heart attack, and Robert was in a pretty severe, I think, mental, emotional valley. So that's when he was asking me, Merlin Miller, and Chester Mass to be worship leaders. He didn't use the term associate pastors, but pastoral support or something like that. So that's how it started. The further process, I think I can't be judgmental in the sense that I'm ever going to go back and it would be too late now anyway, but, you know, chide Robert Mast on the way he conducted things. But I think there was overall, there was more Robert Mast in that whole thing of my coming to be pastor than there was congregation. And, I mean, maybe you could say a little more autocratic. And I regret that. Well, I think it was misunderstood by a few folks in the congregation, in the sense that what is it about Harold that makes him the chosen nominee here, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Did they go through a church approval process for the congregation?
It did eventually. Yeah. That was a little. That was awkward at times. The path. I mean, I'm partly. You know, I was an overseer for 7 years and worked with 6 congregations in the Eastern District in calling pastors. And I mean, these aren't things that I designed. I definitely followed a protocol that was made known to each congregation before they even started.
More inclusive?
I think more inclusive, or more opportunities for the congregation to know what they were getting into, or at least attempting to know that.
Had the Virginia Conference completely dropped the lot by then?
Yeah, I don't think the lot was used. I'm trying to remember who would have been the last person at Mount Pleasant to be chosen by lot.
It might have been Amos Wanger as minister. Nina says she remembers a lot in the ceremony and the formality and the seriousness of it, but you can't remember who was nominated, but it wouldn't have been a preacher. It must have been either a deacon. I've been trying to use dates and so forth to see if I can figure out who or what.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to be able to sort it out right here. I think that somehow I and my family observed a calling by lot for another church group. Like, when I wouldn't even have any idea why we were there. But so the Deep Creek split back in the day, like in the early 60s maybe?
That may have been it, because when Eli Kramer left, I believe I did read there was a lot to choose the next pastor, because Charlie Wolfe was in it. Somewhere I have read this recently, but I wasn't interested in that at the time. I was looking for something else. So
right.
It didn't stick, then that may have been it.
So Mount Pleasant had already dropped the lot when that happened, but I remember, you know, seeing the lot being used to call a pastor. What was his, Dave Zook's brother-in-law? Why is it not coming to me? You would know who I'm talking about. He's married to, well, he's passed on now, but this would have been in the Miller family.
Marion,
yes. Then they eventually went to Pantego, right? So I have no idea why I was in this service where Marion was called by lot to be a pastor, but I was there for whatever reason. Probably dragged there, but.
Well, so you started that initiative with you, Chester, and Mullen trying to take some of the load off Robert?
Correct.
Did he not go take a sabbatical for a year or so? When he was going through his depression?
I can't remember the exact sequence of things, but he did admit himself to a mental health facility, Phil Haven, and some counseling, some therapy there. But that was more like a month or something. But then, and I can't remember which came first, but he and Esther also did a year with a church in southern upstate New York, maybe Cortland or not Cortland. Whatever the church was, it was New York, a little north of the Pennsylvania line there. And they were there for a year. Kind of a VS assignment sort of thing.
Okay. I've got family in Cortland.
Oh, really? Yeah, but now I think about it, Cortland's probably not the right name, but it doesn't come to me right now.
While he was gone, did the three of you move more into, or how did it evolve that, did it wind up being you and Mullen, is that correct?
Yes. Well, actually, I was called first as assistant pastor, and in 19...
And they ordained you for that, or licensed?
In 1988-89, I was just licensed at that point. I was assistant pastor to Robert Mast. And then in 89-90, did I say 88-89? And then 89-90, I was... Adonai Nisley was my mentor, senior pastor. So I was mentored by both of them, successively. Then I was called to be pastor sometime in Adonai's mentoring year. I was called to be pastor, and I don't remember exactly when ordination happened, but it was somewhere in there.
Was Merlin ordained also?
Yes.
Before or after that?
I don't remember the exact time, but very shortly after Adonai, well, by that time he had gone to Deep Creek, but very shortly after that, Merlin and I came on as a team with him. I don't know if we called it associate pastor or assistant pastor, but yeah, the two of us worked together for, I guess, about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. What was the hardest thing you had to face being a pastor, the most difficult part of being a pastor?
Yeah, good question.
By example, I know in talking to Dale, his most difficult thing is counseling, because he has no patience. You know, he's a relatively good coach, and so he doesn't listen well. He has no problem preaching.
So, I don't know if you know anything about the Augsburger brothers,
Myron
being Myron and David and Don. Don has passed on now. David Augsburger said to a group of us that he was addressing one time, he said, "Well, I have two brothers, both have unique gifts. The one will say, well, yeah, tell me about that. Can you, and the other one will say, well, here's what you ought to do." So you probably know at least well enough to know which is which there, but. So you were saying that was Dale's most difficult thing. I think probably this isn't so much a task. This is more the whole milieu in which I worked. I think just being pastor of the church where I had grown up, parents, aunts, uncles, siblings, and so on, that was probably the most challenging, I guess. A whole host of things. I think initially it was more what I felt rather than what actually was happening to me. People with whom I had been buddies before suddenly would throw away their cigarette and crush it out when they saw me coming, or be more careful about their language or whatever. And That was just difficult for me. Mm-hmm. That let's see, what has changed here?
You're one of the guys.
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't. You know, I was kind of set apart or whatever. But anyway, if it was just that, I probably wouldn't identify it as a major problem. But later on, in particular with Leonard and Elsa, it became very, very difficult to function as a pastor. And also at that point, up until 1996, I guess, I still had some involvement with the farm. Mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, and I couldn't effectively be both. I'm glad you asked that question, because while I don't want to be a griper, I'm getting now to what was the very most difficult for me, and that was my exit as pastor after 18 years. You may or may not remember Jim Meador. Were you?
Vaguely.
Yeah, it's okay.
He was pastor when we came back to the church.
Okay. He was interim pastor. What was he here for a year or was it 2 years? I can't remember.
I don't know, but he left about 6 months after we came back.
Yeah. So again, I was educated about ways of handling exits. Lord Weaver gave me a book or a booklet on this subject called Running Through the Thistles. It was the topic of, you know, how does a pastor appropriately, kindly, considerately, honestly, you know, exit a church? Assume the church has come to love the pastor and the pastor loves the people. Mm-hmm. Church. And but only in 7 years of oversight ministry did I really learn better ways of doing that, practically doing. Mm-hmm. That. So it just so happened, of all the, in my estimation, of all the interim pastors we might have called, Jim was one of the most sensitive to the former pastor getting out of the way, which, that's understandable. The transition doesn't happen if the former pastor is still there, you know, interfering. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I mean, I grew up here. And one very good example, I think, of the dilemma was, you know, ever since Clyde and Donnie Dickerson's death in 1961?
Somewhere in that period.
Yeah, I think it was so long, long time ago. I think Sylvia Dickerson always saw me, whether pastor or not, as something like, I was a twin. Donnie and I were the same age.
Oh, I didn't realize.
So, and Donnie was her youngest, right. What, 13? Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, I guess I was the son she didn't have. But anyway, that was okay. Many a pastoral visit, you know, and so on. So when Sylvia died, Shirley first called me, even though Jim was on the scene as mm-hmm. pastor. First of all, Shirley's my first cousin, you know. And I saw nothing wrong with responding to Shirley's call and just giving some pastoral care, I guess, both on behalf of her grandmother and also Shirley herself. As you know, someone who's known a lot of tragedy, and Jim was not happy about that, and just real antsy about anywhere where I would show myself on the scene. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, it wasn't like Jim was already there, and I came and butted in. You know, grandmother just passed, and Shirley gives me a call. Mm-hmm. And said, most or all of the cases where I was working with a pastoral transition later on, we do some kind of memo of understanding, very carefully worked out, so that both the incoming, whether it's interim pastor or not, the incoming pastor knew what was expected and what the parameters were, and the outgoing pastor knew the same.
You had decided to leave. Was there any or when you came to that decision and let it be known to the other church leaders, what kind of feedback did you get?
Not a lot, but I would say what I had a few who wondered out loud, you know, why I was leaving now. I certainly had, you know, there was some kind of send-off for Rose and me. I don't know if, I can't remember if you and Linda might have been present at that.
When I have it doesn't mean I remember it.
Yeah, right. Well, anyway, be that as it may, I mean, church did a nice scrapbook, which individual families were invited to contribute to, mm-hmm. and so a lot of good memories there. I didn't really hear much comment on this, but you know that we, in 2004, just a year and a half before I ended up leaving, we had the misunderstanding about moving the church to the school location and making it both a church and a school. Mm-hmm. But we had also done some attempts, pretty significant attempts at healing and you know, binding up the wounds. I think with generally a lot of satisfaction, but there were still a few people on either side, maybe a few people who thought it's probably time for, you know, and there were others who said, I remember one person specifically said, Harold, why are you leaving now? After you've done this work to heal the wounds and try to, it wasn't just me, but those who teamed up with me. You know, we've come to a point of more understanding and acceptance maybe of each other that, yeah, why now?
What happened? See, I wasn't here then, so I'd have no experience with that. Because Eric was on the committee to draw something up, and so I tangentially heard things, but I had really wasn't interested, and was out of town working in Richmond too. So, what happened there?
Yeah, well, certainly I gave Eric and Sharon an apology, and I owed them an apology. I'll just try to put it in brief terms anyway. This dream was floated about moving the church to the school. This was following the pretty significant expansion of real estate on the school site, and also the beginning, already some of the development had started, but the beginning of the school going from being surrounded by peach orchard to being surrounded by houses, a very significant number of houses, as nobody knows better than you. And it just seemed like, not only to me, but to some others as well, that this was a fantastic opportunity to provide some recreational space for the surrounding communities. At that point, Chesapeake seemed really short on recreational space. There have been a number of such big, since that time, there have been a number of contributions, mm-hmm. to solving that problem. I mean, one would be the Dan Yoder property down, mm-hmm. by the railroad tracks. Another would be the, what is that called, the Southeast, the baseball complex off of...
Oh, yeah.
Off, mm-hmm. of...
down past in Hickory.
Right, off of Easton Road.
Yeah.
In addition to that, as there was more talk in church council, leadership council, and the like, to me anyway, it seemed like the orientation, the mood, seemed to be moving in favor, mm-hmm. Of such a thing. So there was a prayer meeting, one, I think it was a Saturday morning or something like that, where church council, leadership council, school board all got together for a morning of prayer and discernment, and the approval was unanimous, mm-hmm. in that. And so my first big mistake, unanimity among the leaders doesn't mean unanimity in the entire congregation. Mm-hmm. And so I should have just known that from the beginning. But as plans continued forward, and we certainly announced this,
you know, to the congregation about this meeting and the unanimous agreement, et cetera, but didn't really ask at that point for any further feedback. Mm-hmm. So at some point shortly thereafter, it was, I mean, the first step was to hire an architect. Mistake number two, hired the wrong architect. Do you remember who I'm
talking? I wasn't here.
You weren't here? Okay. Let's just say he was a friend of Sam Skaggs, and that wasn't why he was hired, but pretty unique as a professional architect, in that also he was a member of the church over in Kempsville. The biggest mistake that I made was allowing him to pursue, which is definitely his MO, a kind of, I want to surprise you with something grand and mm-hmm. glorious. I should have known Mount Pleasant Mennonite Church doesn't really look forward to surprises.
Especially those that have grand and glorious.
Yes, yes.
Does not fit the ethos.
So he was invited, well, let me back up. Why he was invited. So there would have been Philip Miller in particular was a gung-ho fan. And Philip, in my estimation, had very little awareness of what Christ-like discernment in a church community. Basically, Philip was, hey, if it wins by 51%, we've got it. You know, nothing more to worry about. Well, all of us know better than that. So he was invited to preach and to present this thing. Well, that's a huge mistake. So
why?
Because the guy who has thousands of dollars to make on the approval of this plan is the guy preaching that this is God's will, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, and you know, I'm sure that Eric was one of the most adamant on the other side.
Oh, no, so, I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Well,
I just knew he was involved. I had no idea which side it was.
There was another one who greatly opposed that. So we should have found a way before rather than after to find some common ground and in an honest, straightforward fashion figure out who was where on this before we invited. I'm so bummed that I can't remember the guy's name before we invited him to preach. But that didn't happen, and so after he preached, there was a vote, and definitely there were many questions in the minds of members, parishioners, that were, one, unanswered, and they were legitimate questions, like, well, what are you going to do with the current church building? So the vote comes out at 60-40 or something like that. Well, even those of us who favored thought this would be a death knell for the congregation to go ahead on a 60-40 and assume that 60%, if it remained that high, would have also carried the full financial and other responsibility for making it a success. So after we realized that that was a no-go, all the leadership council, we made sure that every person who had voted negatively was visited and listened to, and that included Eric and Sharon. So I think there was some healing, partly because of that, and partly because we didn't pursue moving ahead with a simple majority, so that maybe just relaxed people a little bit.
Was that the end of it then?
At that point, Keith Miller was very helpful in, I guess, at least starting a path forward logistically. Specifically, it had to do with fundraising and that kind of thing. And I guess the alternative plan was to, if we move forward, to do so in increments, not just a win all or lose all kind of arrangement. So, yeah, that was also at the same time that Bertie's Dairy Farm was about to fall. So I admit that helped.
How did you come to that decision to come back and rescue the farm?
Well, I think the biggest thing, Alan, was that, and this is, I'm not trying to criticize Leonard Orr, so I don't know if you know, I had a few redemptive kinds of encounters with Leonard. I'm happy about that, I hope. But the reality was that Mom and Dad had what some legal experts would have said was an unacceptable high level of liability, coupled with basically losing their income, the rent that they had been receiving from Leonard dried up. So part of it was just how we take care of Mom and Dad here. I guess that was probably the main motivation. I went with the concept that, well, do this for one or two decades and then do the next assignment for one or two decades. And just, so it wasn't anything that really super frightened me, but I could well have, well, in fact, Rose wanted me to take off a month or two, just take off, you know, and I didn't do that. I was in real big hurry to get this done, you know, make the next move and move on. While I don't regret that I did it, I do regret that I kind of pushed it forward faster than I might have done.